moving on then a bit to the relationship between science and ethics and how all that relates to this. So I have mentioned this a bit before, this way in which objectivity can apply to both. So there are these two senses of objectivity, the term objectivity in widespread in English. So there's objectivity as a God's eye view, so objectivity as an absolute position. But there's also the sense in which you can use it in an everyday sense. When we ask someone to be more objective, we're asking them to try and stretch the ego a bit, really, or to take a slightly wider perspective, to try and get out of the cognitive model they may have got stuck in, something of that kind. So I think to use objectivity in an incremental way, it's not a complete departure from the way people use it. It is a departure from the way scientists and analytic philosophers usually use it, which is the first sense. So basically, if we think of beliefs as not so much true or false, but simply more justified or less justified in experience, and we've got those two basic conditions for justification, coherence, and fallibility. So the more we've got those, then the more we can have an objective and integrated set of beliefs. Now, another thing I've mentioned earlier on is the way in which representationalism is associated with the fact-value distinction. So if we're going to avoid representationalism and avoid simply having a sense of meaning based on possible truth or falsity, then we can't accept that sort of classic model by which science is distinguished from ethics. For example, factual claims are distinguished from ethics, whereby factual claims have this sort of objective, in the old-fashioned sense, status, and values don't. So I would reject really the belief that science is intrinsically more objective because it deals with facts. I don't think it's it's not the relationship that scientific theory has with truth, or when it represents things out there, which makes it objective. It's the way in which it's the objectivity in the other sense with which science works that makes it effective and makes it objective. If you take that view of science, this does allow a unified view of objectivity, so it allows us to think of scientific and moral and aesthetic objectivity in the same sort of way, obviously applied in different ways, but the basic mechanism is the same in each case. It involves the integration of belief in each case. So if we try and think of objectivity like this, it's equivalent to integration in effect, and that means it's found not in states of affairs or the relationship between representations and states of affairs. It's found instead in people. It's found in people's habits. It's found in people's habits at an individual level, but also people's habits at a group level. So societies could be more or less objective, or groups could be more or less objective in that sense. And the habitual attitudes of people. And I think this is what effectively it follows from the stuff we did yesterday, in a way, is that since we recognise that meaning for us is embodied, I don't see how we can avoid this conclusion, in the sense that if meaning is embodied, then objectivity must be embodied. The way in which we understand things. The way in which that's particularly focused, I think, is in judgment. So the point at which we can, we test and apply our objectivity is when we make a judgment. So it's not just a question of, is this person objective? Is Sangharakshita more objective than David Cameron or whatever? You know, the measuring the person as a whole. Because obviously people do vary, as we've been saying. You know, we want to avoid a fixed view about these people. But at any one given point where they make a judgment about something, there's going to be a set of habits and attitudes and models and so on which are being applied. Perhaps applied in consultation with others, but so you might think about a group judgment which is being applied at a particular time through consultation, or you might think focus it on an individual making a judgment in an everyday setting. But either way, it's judgment that becomes the important point, the point at which objectivity can be in some way assessed. So if we're going to talk about better science, improving science or progress in science or in ethics or in art, that's going to happen through the people doing it having better judgments for each time they make a judgment of some kind.
That makes sense for me. Of something I had a problem with, I raised this with Stephen as well, when you hear people talking about the Kalama Sutta and talking about I can't remember the exact wording, but saying that, you know, when should you value things or consider them to be a good thing to do or whatever, and refers to experience, but also refers to the wise, these people called the wise. And I was very, very suspicious of that in terms of, it seems at odds with some of the other ideas in there. It's like almost like just authority coming in through the back door, divine authority or authority of the guru or whatever. But this being able to see somebody who's wiser than someone else as being somebody who's more integrated, somebody who's more objective, somebody who can, who has more coherent, and I like that. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And that's what would enable you to interpret the Kalama Sutta as saying that somebody who is wise would think in this particular way.
And it also kind of links in with virtue ethics as well.
Yeah.
Kind of makes sense of that, because there's a circularity in virtue ethics that you were talking about the other day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's the trouble with virtue ethics is it relies on the person as a whole over time when people change.
Right, right.
Over time, which is why I want to put the emphasis on judgments at a specific time.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Obviously in that judgment, there are various things that can be taken into account which include the consequences of your actions, for example. But we'll talk more about that tomorrow. The key message here is that the criteria are psychological for objectivity, that they're not just about the evidence, important as evidence is, and in the way that it feeds into the total process, but the judgment of objectivity is a psychological one, because it depends on the kind of states that are brought to judgments when we make them. So
at the beginning of the week you talked about rationalism and how you felt that there was a real synergy between these two. During the course of the week, has that just confirmed this synergy, or have you noticed in any differences from your view? Because you were saying that's the thing that you gravitated most to before you came here. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I think it's, I didn't really have a model which took in things that could not be rationally proven, as in the aesthetic side. So I would say I would probably swung to a more balanced view of things you can't rationally prove, as well as that which you can. So I think I've got a slightly broader view of it now.
Could this still fit into your rationalist model, or does it break it?
I think it is becomes a meta model, which is one further step, sort of bigger than the rational model. I think it takes into account more of experience than the rationalist model can. And there becomes a sort of a widening. Mm. So that I think, you know, with rational thought, you can only get so far. But that doesn't say the rationalist model isn't a useful way of looking at things. And I think I still would, in many contexts, use that because it's easier to articulate than the sort of more aesthetic side of experience, which is harder to pin down using words and therefore hard to use in an argumentative sort of discussion. I probably end up being very vague, trying to use the bigger picture in a lot of contexts.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you're within a single cognitive model and you're having a discussion with someone who is pretty much in the same one, it's no problem. You accept the same, basic assumptions and you accept the meanings of the terms you're using. This isn't always the case, but if those kind of conditions are met, then all you need to do is reason within the terms of that model.
Yes. And maybe that's actually part of our problem as a species, if you like, or a cultural problem, is that you can operate within a particular cognitive model in the scientific technological world that we live in. And so the kind of, it reinforces this kind of tendency to hive off morality and aesthetics from technology and science, because for all practical purposes, because of, a lot of us buy into similar cultural assumptions and so on, we just go along within the same cognitive model. What I'm beginning to get my head around as the week goes on is this idea that, like you're saying, rational thought can only get you so far, but I'm beginning to get this idea more that it's not just that rational thought can only get you so far, you can't actually get started with rational thought until you've got some kind of, it's a way of understanding aesthetics and meaning and value. And I think that's not putting into words very well, but I get what you said at the beginning of the week. It's like you start to sort of get a sense of what's being said, but you can't actually articulate it. So that's what my ramblings are attempting to do, but I'm not being very successful at the moment.
Do you have any thoughts, Kat?